Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the hottest internet radio show and podcast, The Author's Lab, a place for an eclectic and lively discussion of the dynamic world of writing, publishing, and marketing of the written word. I am the sage, the griot, and the host, Robert Batista. Follow me on Twitter at author R. Batista, and make it a point to follow The Author's Lab on Blog Talk Radio. Just click the follow button on our page. Today, we are honored and excited to have as our guest the multifaceted and talented Duaiwa Frazier. Duaiwa, welcome to the Author's Lab.
Thank you so much, Rob. Thank you for having me. I appreciate your support. And you have a wonderful radio show, and you've been doing this for years. And the literary community is grateful to have you.
Well, back at you, because I've been seeing what you've been doing, and you've just, left no stone unturned in coming out with your books and everything else. And that TED Talk was awesome, so we'll get into that. So I want to first say, Duaiwa, start off by saying it's so good reconnecting with you and your dynamic spirit again. Let me sound off on your many talents. You are an award-winning writer, speaker, educator, and consultant. With one of your speakings was, as I said, the prestigious TED Talks, which we will discuss later on the show. But first, I'd like to talk about your new inspiring children's book called Alice's Musical Debut. Let's talk about the germination internal concept of why you chose to write this story.
Thank you so much, and I'd love to discuss this. My new book, Alice's Musical Debut, is a children's picture book. The genre is historical fiction, and I actually began, the seed ideas and the some research for this book during the time that I was in my MFA, which is Master of Fine Arts, graduate degree program in New York City at the New School. I had a professor, a wonderful professor, Hetty Jones, who many people may know. She's a notable poet and author, and she had a class in which we workshopped our writing and we discussed writing ideas, and she very much was supportive and encouraging us as graduate writing students to not only pursue writing for children, but to think about writing diverse stories for children, to delve into history, and to think about writing about individuals that we don't often see stories about for children. And I grew up around music and the arts. My parents, my dad, very much into jazz music, and so of course I grew up hearing John Coltrane and Miles Davis and Thelonious Monk and all those great jazz artists. But as I got older, I got into looking for other artists and thinking about women artists and women's contribution to music and the arts. And so I discovered Alice Coltrane just in my, listening to jazz and doing research. And she was the wife of John Coltrane, who we all know, but many people don't know of Alice Coltrane, that she was a great jazz pianist, organist, harpist, and composer in her own right. She was also
a familiar.
And before she even married John, she was traveling and she was performing, and she had her own band and was doing great things. And then these two artists got together, of course, and they created their own works and producing great jazz. So she was a person that I was interested in, just me as a researcher or as someone who loves the arts, and I want to find out more about great women and great artists. So I started doing research on her. I found some information on her that was not on the internet, and it's at the Schomburg. And you know, living in New York, the Schomburg Center for Research, African American Research and Culture, is a great place to conduct research on subjects that you may not have at your fingertips on the internet. And so I was able to find some literature on Alice Coltrane, because there were no books written on her in particular. She's mentioned in literature with John's life, John Coltrane, and of course they married and had children together, and unfortunately John passed at a young age. But Alice Coltrane ran his, many people don't know that after even his passing, you know, she was responsible for his music publishing and many of the, you know, you might hear his music in commercials or movies and things like that. And so for many years, in addition to composing her own music and also living in California on an ashram, you know, in which she was kind of away from mainstream culture for many years, she managed John Coltrane publishing estate, and also did some of her last recordings in the early to mid-2000s, and I was privileged to see one of Alice Coltrane's last concerts. I'm kind of leading up to why I really decided to do this historical fiction story. I saw one of her last concerts. It wasn't her last. I think she had one last one after it. But her last concert on the East Coast, which was in the early 2000s at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center. And she had a wonderful band, orchestra there, rather, including her son, Robbie Coltrane, who was a jazz saxophonist. And this was in promotion of her last album, Translinear Light. And the music was quite beautiful. Reading interviews with her, with Essence Magazine's the former editor-in-chief, Susan Taylor, who interviewed her around that time, she discussed that her music was spiritual. And she discussed her work on an ashram in California, and she discussed John Coltrane's legacy. And as I listened to much of her music on YouTube during that time to try to understand, wow, who is this woman, you know,
right.
I just became so intrigued with her. I was like, I really want to write a children's story about her, and I don't know how it's going to come about, but I started doing the research, and it took a long while, obviously, because this story is just being published in 2019. The story went through many revisions and different angles, but I settled upon just, you know, a bit of how I might imagine Alice's childhood one day in her life, because it is written that she began playing piano and she was in children's choirs in the church that she grew up in Detroit at the age of 7. And I thought, wow, if I started around that time for a children's story, it may be very not only inspiring for children, but also a really impactful point of a child learning and development of their talent. At, you know, 6, 7 years of age, many children are being introduced to things that help them grow, you know, in the future with their talent. And so when I read that in her biography, that she was playing piano at 7, that's something that gripped me. And then I understood more of what her journey was into becoming this great artist and a mate to another great artist, you know, John Coltrane. So that's where the inspiration for this story comes from. And I do want to mention my disclaimer. So this is historical fiction, meaning Alice Coltrane is a person who lived. However, I am not, you know, saying that I'm right, that I wrote a biography, that I knew her life from start to finish, or that, you know, I was there in her childhood. So that's, you know, my legal disclaimer. This is a work of historical fiction for children. It's my imagination in considering a person who lived and wanting to inspire children, and that's it.
Right, because on your book's Amazon page, you say it right up front. Alice's musical debut reimagines one day in the childhood of the late jazz pianist, harpist, composer, and organist Alice Coltrane. It also says, Alice's musical debut reveals the magical connection young Alice McLeod has with nature sounds and musical rhythms. Alice's musical debut is a story filled with poetic language and imagery that speaks to the hearts of all children. Dwayne, we'll talk about how important it is to develop these connections of imaginative images of musical rhythms and poetic language early in the lives of our children.
Wow. Well, I would say, you know, definitely I don't want to tell parents or others how to, you know, raise their children, but I would say that I'm going to reflect on my own childhood, and that it was filled with music. It was filled with, you know, I come from a family that, you know, when we were kids, it was like, go play outside, you know, or, you know, my mother was really into the arts. And, you know, when she was really trying to expose us to a lot of things, it was, you know, we're going to an international arts festival. We're going to see, my mother took me when I was 7 to see Sonia Sanchez at, you know, one of the university lecture series. So I didn't remember meeting Sonia Sanchez, but later, you know, the connection was made real. And then, you know, when I became a poet, and then I met Sonia Sanchez as an adult. And so what I think about that with your statement of the musical rhythms and, you know, the nature and imagination is that what you expose children to when they're very young may often blossom later in life, whatever that
right.
that may be, whether it's positive, whether it's negative, whether it's, you know, bountiful and fruitful, or whether it's, you know, in lack, or, you know, other things that are not so great for kids. Whatever you expose them to, they may become. And so, you know, my parents exposed me to music, to art, to dance at a very young age. I became that. I became a writer and a performer and someone who promotes the arts. And I, as a K-12 educator, I was also trying to infuse that into, you know, how I facilitate lessons, or how I talk to my kids, and books that I expose them to. So that's really my belief, where I come from. You know, whatever it is you hope and want your kids to be, just consider that, you know, what you expose them to, they're going to absorb it, either, you know, intentionally or unintentionally. And so that's my perspective on that. And then it appears in this story, Alice's musical debut, one, in reflecting on the things of my childhood that I really appreciated, but also, two, in chief, thinking about Alice, who became a great musical artist, not just a jazz artist, but a great artist in general, with all of her works and collaborations with John Coltrane. And I thought backwards, what kind of childhood, or what days and what activities could the child of this later adult could have experienced on their journey to becoming this great artist. So that's, you know, kind of what I reflected on as this story was crafted.
Dwayne, is this your first book you wrote for children? And talk about the difference in writing for this audience as opposed to your other stories.
Sure. This is actually my second book for children. My first book, 10 Marbles and a Bag to Put Them In, Poems for Children, was published in 2002, and it's a book that I normally use when I facilitate workshops for schools or libraries, and there will be really very young children involved from age, you know, 3 to age 6 or 7. However, this is my first children's picture book. And I would even say, you know, it's my first work that is features an African-American character, that features aspects of African-American culture, you know, with music and with an African-American mom in the story, because Alice's mom is in the story, Mrs. McCloud. So it's definitely a first for me in a lot of ways with this genre. I would say the difference is, you know, this story took several years to come to fruition. You're really not only thinking about what will grasp the young reader, but I'm also considering what are some of those elements, whether in illustration, in the aesthetics for the book, in description for the book, that it's not only a work of creative writing, but it's also, it's a product. It's a work that will be marketed. So the things that I had to consider when crafting this story and thinking about how to share it with the community, thinking about teachers, thinking about parents, what do they need? So I think that that may be a bit different than perhaps how I might think about a YA story or even some of the poetry I've written in the past, although I would hope all of it could be introduced for educators. For this book, it's thinking about the level of education. So the grade right. range for this is grade 2 and up. Obviously, we know that there's some kids that are really great readers at age 5 and age 6, but just in general, knowing that I was a K-12 teacher, I set my range at age 7 and up, just so that parents and educators would kind of have a marker for the young readers who could read this either with an adult or by themselves. And so those are some of the things I would consider for that.
Alice's musical debut is set in the 1940s, a great period of eclectic jazz, film noir, great literature, and other wonderful artistic creations. Duwewa, how was it delving into that time period and researching it?
Sure. Well, that time period, it came about because this is the time period in which Alice Coltrane would have been, you know, a 7-8-year-old child who is learning music and being exposed to music and culture. And I want to read in specific, at the very end of the book, I do share a biography of Alice Coltrane, and this is also something that anyone can access through Googling her name. And, you know, this is not verbatim. I didn't, you know, plagiarize, but it is paraphrased and putting together the different literature that's out on Alice Coltrane. So I want to mention that Alice Coltrane was born Alice McCloud on August 27, 1937, in Motor City, Detroit, Michigan. She grew up in Mount Olive Baptist Church, learning church hymnals, which gave Alice a foundation in spiritual music. I want to go further into this biography by giving another bit of Black history, which is it was at Mount Olive Baptist Church that Alice learned to play piano and organ for the church's choirs, the senior choir, the pastor's choir, and the young people's choir. Alice also trained at the Mack Avenue Church of God in Christ with Lemon Gospel Choir. And it was at Mack Avenue Church that it was the home for Dolores Ranson and David Winans, the parents of Detroit's most famous gospel singing family, the Winans. So I just thought that was very interesting to go ahead and connect that history, because right at the time in the 1940s, as you mentioned, in which Alice was learning music and singing in church choirs, the Winans family was also getting started. And we know that they have many of their children, grandchildren, have been a part of our music history. So I would say that that is what I researched, and that's what came up in the information in that time period for Alice and what was going on in Detroit at that time. And I also know there were many other, as you mentioned, great musical artists coming out at that time. But in specific to this story, in the 1940s, It is stated that that's when Alice was learning to play piano and getting involved with the children's choir. And so that is the aspect that I dealt with. But in specific with the illustrations in the story, those people who may purchase this book will see that Alice's mother and Alice, in terms of their look and their image, is very much reflected in the 1940s style of dress and appearance for women at that time. So I just
right.
want to note that I worked with my illustrator on the look and feel for that.
Duewa, you have graciously agreed to read a portion of your book for us. Can you do this now and set up the part that you're reading?
I certainly will. You know, I'm going to start from the very beginning and set this
okay.
up so that anyone listening or potential, you know, parents and educators who may be interested in the book will see that this is where the aspect of imagination and a connection to those rhythms comes from for Alice. And so I'm going to start at the beginning. Somewhere in the heart of Detroit, Alice McLeod cannot sleep. She hears the pop and rumble of a storm. Alice's room shakes from the boom of even louder thunder, and then she hears the crackle and snap of lightning. Alice hears tree branches break and fall to the ground. She rushes out of bed to look out through her window. Alice raises the window and stares out into the night sky, taking in the purple, blue-black darkness of the sky, darkness that is only interrupted by the light from the street lamp. Alice leans in close. She puts her nose against the window screen. She smells what rain, wet trees, and leaves smell like. It's the cleanest smell in the world, she thinks. Alice closes her eyes and listens. Plunk. Alice, come closer. Plunk. Alice, come closer. Plunk, plunk, plunk. The raindrops talk to her. Did the rain just say, Alice, come closer? Surely it didn't. Alice hears the rustle of the leaves in the trees. Swish. Alice, come closer. Swish. Alice, come closer. Swish, swish, swish. The leaves talk to her. Did the leaves just say, Alice, come closer? Alice hears an owl that is perched high up in the tree near her bedroom window. Hoot. Alice, come closer. Hoot. Alice, come closer. Hoot, hoot, hoot. Who is the little owl talking to? The owl is talking. So are the trees and the rain. All of their sounds together are like musical instruments in an accidental band, beckoning Alice to make her own sounds with nature. And so Alice begins to hum. While the thunder rumbles and the lightning claps, while the rain plunks and the trees swish, while the owl hoots, Alice falls asleep. So that is my excerpt of Alice's musical debut, and that's me setting up Alice's world and a night of concern and a little fear that Alice has here in the thunderstorm, but then it actually turns into something that Alice considers when thinking about, I guess, sounds that might soothe you and calm you to go to sleep. And so I thought it was very realistic, not only thinking about things that I went through when I was a kid, you know, when you hear the thunder and the lightning and you get a little bit afraid, but just setting up this story that, you know, children, even a child who becomes a musical genius, they still have those normal things in their life that may scare them or may make them wonder or make them have a little concern. And so that's how the story began.
Yes, I enjoyed that reading. It was extremely, extremely visual and realistic. Duewa, when I go into schools and do talks on my YA book, Street Angel, one of the first things the students say is they love seeing characters that look like them. I would say that would be the same case for Alice's musical debut as well. How important is this?
Sure. I think what we're talking about there is, you know, diversity in our children's books and cultural representation, I think it's very important because we know that in recent years, I would say in the last, you know, 10 to 15 years, there's been really heavy discussions of that more cultural representation and diversity is needed for children across ethnic groups, for children and parents across ethnic and cultural lines in which we don't often see children heavily represented in our children's books, whether it's picture books or whether it's teen young adult novels. And so obviously as an educator, and I'm an African-American educator and writer and artist, I think about these things. I think about the fact that, you know, I did have great children's books growing up. You know, my mother bought, Why Do Mosquitoes Fly in People's Ears? I mean, that was a great African folktale, and that had cultural representation that I could relate to. I remember reading, Ezra Jack Keats' One Snowy Day, where the main protagonist was a child of color, whether it was an African-American child or what we may consider a child of Hispanic heritage. And so while we had some grouping of books when I was growing up, certainly there's a discussion about children who are biracial. There's a discussion about children who are Caribbean. There's a discussion, obviously, about, you know, children, African-American children and Hispanic Latino children who need to see representation, because this representation helps to solidify children's appreciation not only for their own culture but other diverse cultures and groups. It helps solidify children's confidence and belief and pride in themselves. That we don't want to be divisive. Of course, we don't want to say, hey, this group needs more representation than this group. What we want to say is there needs to be a balance. We know that in public schools and in underserved communities, these children are no less deserving of books that represent who they are and represent the dialogue that they hear in their everyday life or the experience that they have. But we want that to be represented in our children's books, and I think the publishing industry is certainly beginning to close this gap. We have books by, and I do want to mention some authors who are really trailblazers and who the publishing industry is widely supporting. You know, authors such as Jacqueline Woodson, who we know has won National Book Awards for many of her books for young readers. We have Kwame Alexander, who is a notable author. He began as a poet, and he's been writing wonderful. He's an African-American author who's been writing wonderful stories for children. Recently, we have the YA book story written by Angie Thomas, who her book, The Hate U Give, published by HarperCollins, a film was created about her book, and we know that her protagonist was a teen African-American girl. And so, you know, we see all these examples, recent examples, that the publishing industry is taking note, but certainly I think more writers of color need to write these stories. I'm only one writer, and I'm happy to do this. I feel this is a part of my purpose. So no one has to sell me on doing this. This isn't, you know, marketing. This isn't, you know, to get in on, hey, you know, we need diverse books, so I'm just going to write a book. I've been doing this for many years. I have an MFA in creative writing with a concentration in writing for children. So this is already a part of my purpose. But I would say, you know, for writers that are coming up and that are emerging and that are still in these grad programs or taking community writing workshops, to please consider writing stories for diverse groups of children. Consider writing historical fiction, and consider adding aspects of nature and imagination, because Black children and children of color need to be represented as doing more than playing basketball, more than rapping, more than hanging out on the stoop. We have many, many diverse stories in our lives. I'm one. I played in the parks. I went fishing with my granddad. I took dance classes. I had an awesome childhood, and I'm not the only Black person that did. So I think that our stories need to be represented in various ways, and, you know, certainly we're beginning to do that.
Yes, we are, and I agree wholeheartedly, and I can't wait to read your memoir when you write it. I know it's going to be awesome. So switch gears. Let's switch gears, Duwewa, and talk about that fantastic TED Talk you did called Word is Bond, where you slayed it. You did a brilliantly masterful job. When did you do it, and how did the talk come about?
Sure. The talk came about because I've been giving professional development workshops for educators. I gave one a few years ago. I gave one this past year that was teaching educators how to use culturally responsive tests, how to use high-interest tests when teaching students. Particularly my workshops of late have been geared toward secondary students, but of course, you know, we can do this for K to 12 in full. Using culturally responsive text, thinking about ways of speaking to children that incorporate current events, and particularly that incorporate the discussion about social justice awareness. We all know what's been going on really throughout history, but let's talk about recent years because we're living in this time, and if you're an educator, you're teaching children of the current generation who may not know about the civil rights movement, who may not know about all of those various time periods in which there was great, great division in our society, in which education was segregated, in which there were many hardships that our folks had to overcome. And so those who are living in this time period, we're reaping many benefits of those movements. However, our children don't know that history. And when they turn on the TV and see these headlines that involve children and adults who look like them, that involve incidences of violence or brutalities, I'm not going to fully go into all of that, but it's a great concern in our communities. It's a great concern for parents, and I feel for educators. Because after some of these incidences, these kids are on summer break, but they're not on a peaceful, enjoyable break when there are things happening in their communities that are concerning, that are involving harm of life and compromising of well-being for themselves, their parents, their grandparents, their friends. And so my TED talk was rooted in educators. Let's think about ways that we can be culturally responsive in delivering instruction that will involve discussion to help our kids through this time period when social justice is one of these issues on the table, when injustices are currently happening and they are headlines in our news, and it is happening in our communities that impact these kids that we're educating. And so I chose to focus on hip-hop as the vehicle in which we introduce children to topics and awareness and social justice. Not because hip-hop is just only concerned with social justice, obviously, I do want to make mention of that, but because our children are already accessing hip-hop in the dominant culture, and not just Black children, these are all children that are heavily keyed into hip-hop and hip-hop culture, and so why not meet these kids where they are with the text, with the lyrics, with the music, even if it's just instrumental, because we know you can't just play all of, you know, Notorious Big's Juicy or all of European Russian's rhymes in your classroom. There may be some curse words, but you can play and you can share a portion of these raps and then discuss what is going on that is crucial in connecting to today. You can talk about Kendrick Lamar and why his recent album that won a Pulitzer Prize was so timely and impactful in discussing social justice issues. And then, you know, of course, he throws a hot beat behind it. So that's where the origin of my TED Talk Word is Bond came from. I'm a hip-hop generation writer and educator, and I'm always going to do that. Even as I age, that's who I am. And so as an educator, those are some of the things that I think about. And that's where the Word is Bond talk came from, to inspire educators.
In your TED Talk, you say, when I use hip-hop in the classroom, my students opened up and came alive and freely discussed their thoughts. That hops on a power of hip-hop for such a positive good. And as you said, education is always evolving. But many now say that with the rigidness of the Common Core quote-unquote concept, it's driving education back to the so-called dark ages. What are your thoughts on this?
I would say, you know what? As an educator, there was always something new. When I started teaching in Brooklyn, there was the balanced literacy reading and writing workshop model that came out of Teachers College. Whatever they told me I needed to do and facilitate, I did. I did it, and I mastered it for the kids, because these were the district requirements. However, that does not hem you up as an educator from being creative for these children. You're the one in that classroom. You're the expert. You're the content expert and master of your area of expertise in that classroom. So for me, they may say Common Core, which I also mastered, and I became a literacy specialist. And I'm saying that to inspire others and inspire educators. Instead of getting caught up in the policies and procedures that you're given at your school or the new regulations and state learning standards that you're given, take it and master it, and then look at how you can be creative and flow in your culturally responsive content. I don't think there's a principal or a school or a district that will tell you not to do for your kids, for the population that you have, to engage them. They would rather those kids be learning in that classroom, and then you align that culturally responsive text and those assignments to the Common Core, than you just teach to the Common Core and you use solely outdated materials that are not engaging your kids, and then they walk in your classroom to observe, and all your kids are acting up, and all of your kids are disconnected from you, and all of your kids are not reading the material and engaging with the material. Does that make sense, Rob?
Yeah, I'm right with you, and that makes a whole lot of sense, and that's basically what you did.
Yes. You have to be culturally responsive no matter what, and this means even if you aren't teaching children of color, you still have to give all children a balance of curriculum, a balance of cultural context, and a balance of genres and types of text and information so that they can all be informed. So that's
key word.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And to me, the key word, as you said, is balance. Now, in closing, Duewa, one of the many aspects of your artistry is that of a spoken word artist. Are you still performing your poetry?
You know, I do occasionally. This book really is chief in my artistic life at this time, Rob. But I have done some recent spoken word and poetry performances, and folks can check out my YouTube. I have two YouTubes, but my most recent one is youtube.com/UAWorld. I have a few videos there that folks may want to check out, two recent poetry performances, and also on my website at duewaworld.com. They can visit the gallery and visit the video section, and you'll see recent videos. I'm still doing it. but I'm currently promoting Alice's musical debut, so that's hot on my priority list right now.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. So if people want to get in contact with you, you just mentioned your website and other. What other places do you want them to get in contact with you?
Sure. You can contact me at duewaworld.com. There you'll see the full list of my books. If you're interested in purchasing a copy of Alice's musical debut, I can autograph the book for you and send and ship it to you individually, and that will be at Lit Noir, LITNOIRE, publishing.co. I'm also at Facebook at Duewa Frazier, my author page, and Twitter at Duewa Frazier 1.
This has been the Author's Lab with me, Robert Batista. My mission is to give creative people a platform to show you who they are. One of my stories, My Baby Has No Name, can be read for free online at spillwords.com. My guest has been Duewa Frazier. Make sure you pick up her brilliant new book, Alice's Musical Debut. Thank you so much, Duewa, for being my guest on the Author's Lab.
Thank you, Rob, for having me. And good luck to you. Best wishes.
And best wishes to you as well. It was a blast. Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you, you too.
This is Robert Batista signing off with this little rhyme. The more the world changes, the more it remains the same. But don't hate the player. Hate the game. Thank you.